Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. An iconic neighborhood restaurant in New York City has a new owner.
He decided that he didn't want us here. He didn't want Cafe Edison. And he wanted a white tablecloth restaurant with a named chef.
The patrons didn't like that at all. Jeff London has the story from New York. Jim Malone is here in the cafe with a story about a possible presidential challenger to Hillary Clinton, if either actually decides to run.
I think it's still an uphill challenge for anyone to beat Hillary Clinton, but she will have challengers, and likely a relatively strong challenge from the left during the primary.
And Roseanne Scurble stops in with a story of a new way to portray the dinosaurs that once roamed the United States.
We deconstruct the world that they lived in by looking at the mechanics of how they lived, how they ate, who they lived with, what plants they fed on.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. Many American communities have a local family-owned restaurant that holds a special place in the neighborhood's heart. Near New York City's Times Square, that would be Cafe Edison. Last weekend, about 50 protesters and some media outlets held a rally to save the diner, whose clientele includes everyone from Broadway luminaries to tourists. People carried signs, local politicians spoke, and a quartet sang.
It starts with the cafe's founders and the way they made sure customers were treated right.
It's just you pay attention to them. You whisk them, you clip them a little bit. You have to make them home, yes?
That's Frances Edelstein, a Polish Holocaust survivor who opened the place with her husband Harry in 1980. We spoke over a decade ago after Neil Simon wrote a play set in the Cafe Edison called 45 Seconds from Broadway.
She's like a Jewish mother, which she really is, and she wants you to eat.
So did her late husband, Harry. They served up what could only be called Jewish soul food. Blintzes, latkes, matzo ball soup.
So that's what makes us famous here. We're making everyday different soups. Just what we got, matzo ball and noodle soup every day.
And they made sure everybody ate, says Manny Eisenberg, who's produced most of Neil Simon's plays and is a regular. He remembers one man who sold knockoff watches in Times Square.
This man would come to the restaurant and go to the counter and only order soup. And Harry, being a busybody, after the third or fourth time the man came in, he said, "Why don't you eat something?" And the man said he couldn't afford it, but he had the soup because they're hearty soups in the winter. The man turns out to be a Muslim from Africa. Harry is a Holocaust-surviving Jew. And he proceeded to give orders that whenever this man comes in, he's to be fed at no cost. It's one of the great American stories.
The producer says he reached deals on the cafe's napkins. Playwright August Wilson sketched scenes on napkins. The Edelsteins were even given a special Tony Award for serving the industry. Everyone was family, and after Harry Edelstein died, his son-in-law, Conrad Stroll, ran the business the same way. But the Edison Hotel's new owner wants to upgrade the space, says Stroll.
He decided that he didn't want us here, didn't want Cafe Edison, and he wanted a white tablecloth restaurant with a named chef.
The cafe certainly isn't that, but it does have the kind of old-time New York charm, like vaulted plaster ceilings, that's becoming increasingly rare, especially around Times Square, says historian Anastasia Mann, who's been coming to the Cafe Edison for about 15 years.
Look at the ceilings. Not a lot of ceilings like that left in the city. It's the Blintzes, for sure. The waitress who calls me baby. Very few people in the world I like to call me baby, but she's one of them.
And when the news got out that the cafe was being evicted right after Christmas, a groundswell of support erupted on Facebook and other social media. The theater community, as well as regular customers, banded together to try to save the cafe, with a petition that's gotten around 9,000 signatures and lunch mobs on weekends. If the cafe closes, more than 30 employees, most of whom are immigrants like its founders, will be out of work. Polish-born waitress Maria Horomańska, who's worked at the Cafe Edison for 5 years, says she's sad and angry, but perks up when asked about her favorite foods on the menu.
Pastrami on the right, yum. Cheese blintzes, yum. Kasza Weneska, wow. That's I grew up on. That's why I love it.
And that's why a lot of people who make what's lovingly called the Polish Tea Room a regular destination will miss it if and when it closes. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
A prominent group of liberal activists is urging Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren to run for president in 2016. Warren has said she's not interested, and public opinion polls show former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton remains a huge favorite for the Democratic Party nomination should she run. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
The liberal activist group MoveOn.org says a poll of its 8 million members around the country shows overwhelming support for a presidential run by one of the Senate's leading liberal Democrats, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. MoveOn said 81% of those surveyed support the idea of a Warren candidacy. Warren has become a favorite with progressive activists since she took office in January 2013 by often speaking out on the issue of income disparity in the United States. Anna Galland is the executive director for MoveOn.org Civic Action.
We have a crisis in our democracy, a crisis in our economy. It's not working for middle class and working families. Senator Warren has built her entire career around fighting for those families, and we want to see that reflected, that message, that cause. We want to see that reflected by her running in the presidential primary.
Warren has said repeatedly she has no plans to run for president in 2016, but Gallen says Warren was encouraged to run for Senate in Massachusetts by progressive activists, and she believes it could work again.
We will launch a significant effort. We will hire organizers in early primary states. We will open offices there. We'll spend $1 million just to start to make sure that Senator Warren understands that millions of Americans, including millions of MoveOn members, are deeply excited about her and how she fights for working people in the middle class.
In her brief time in the Senate, Warren has emerged as a leading proponent of a form of economic populism that seeks to improve working and middle-class families while reining in the abuses of moguls on Wall Street.
Wall Street is doing very well. CEOs are bringing in millions more, and families all across this country are struggling. We have to make this government work for the American people, and that's what we're here to fight for.
Public opinion polls show that if she runs, Warren would be an underdog in a Democratic presidential field that includes former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. A recent CNN ORC poll showed Clinton with the support of 65% of the Democrats surveyed, followed by Warren at 10% and Vice President Joe Biden at 9%. Biden has said he'll decide on a presidential run in the next several months. Clinton is expected to announce her presidential intentions early in 2015. She did campaign on behalf of Democratic candidates in the recent congressional midterm elections and is a frequent speaker at conferences that focus on empowering women.
The Democratic Party is at its best, just like America is at its best, when we rally behind a very simple yet powerful idea: family. Family is the building block of any society. It's the building block of our party and our country.
Despite talk about Elizabeth Warren, Clinton remains the clear Democratic favorite, says analyst John Fortier of the Bipartisan Policy Center.
So I think it's still an uphill challenge for anyone to beat Hillary Clinton, but she will have challengers and likely a relatively strong challenge from the left during the primary.
Even if Warren decides against a presidential run, experts say other liberal candidates are considering getting into the race. Among them are Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley and Vermont Senator Bernard Sanders, an independent who usually votes with Democrats. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
46 million years ago, the last dinosaurs roamed what is now the American West. As VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports, their demise is pieced back together from the fossils they left behind in a new exhibit at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington.
Here's what 7-year-old Ella Smith thinks of dinosaurs.
They're very old and cool and very big.
Ella and her mother, Paige, have wandered into a recreation of the world just before an asteroid struck the planet, destroying the dinosaurs and practically everything else. What unfolds is a preview of the new National Fossil Hall coming in 2019, says Cara Blonde, exhibitions director at the museum.
We use a couple of our major specimens to kind of as the anchors for the story, and we deconstruct the world that we lived in, that they lived in, by looking at the mechanics of how they lived, how they ate, who they lived with, what plants they fed on.
These dinosaurs lived in what is now the arid American West. But back then it was a pretty tropical place with a seaway running through it. The deltas extending from that seaway turned out to be a perfect place to die and, over time, to fossilize. This explains why the area is so fossil-rich. The uncovered remains document the birds, small mammals, and reptiles that survived after the dinosaurs died off, says exhibit curator Kay Berensmeyer.
Turtles survived. There are many aquatic ones. If they were hiding out in the water, they had more of a chance to do that, to get through. And earthworms, we actually have burrows from earthworms that are just an inch or two above the impact layer.
The striations on a rock in the exhibit show when the asteroid hit, triggering a mass extinction. Museum fossil hunters continue to send back what they dig up in the field. Some make it to the fossil lab, where volunteer Bill King sorts ancient crocodile bones.
It's like crime scene investigators, only there wasn't any crime. It's just nature and millions of years ago. And we get to do it all, hands-on, at no charge.
The flowering of the planet after the dinosaurs shows that the Earth is resilient and can regenerate over time. But humans are now driving rapid global shifts in the climate. Kay Berensmeyer says we are already seeing serious consequences like species extinction and more severe weather.
So I think with this knowledge, we just have to be very careful about how we try to preserve the components of our ecosystems today that will allow this future regeneration to continue.
Berensmeyer hopes visitors of all ages take away a deeper understanding that dinosaurs were once part of an ecosystem they depended on, just like us. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
Illuminated buildings, especially ones with a lot of glass, are deadly for birds. Experts estimate that more than 100 million migrating birds die each year in North America when they become confused by artificial lights at night and collide with the glass buildings. In response, a growing movement to save birds from the fatal collision has been taking place in major U.S. cities. VOA's June So has more on so-called lights out campaigns. Carol Pearson narrates.
There's a bird here. It's a woodpecker.
This is one of several dead birds Lisbeth Fuse's team found one morning at the base of glass buildings.
Very beautiful. See the red head?
Volunteers, mostly amateur birders, travel a 6-kilometer route in downtown Washington every day before dawn during migratory seasons. They skirt around the edges of buildings, collecting fallen birds before they're eaten by predators or swept away by cleaning crews. Fuse says the area has many buildings that pose a danger to migrating birds.
Large expanses of glass that were lit at night that have plants inside the building, because if a bird sees a plant in a building and it doesn't perceive the glass and it runs into the windows, and then they're attracted to the light.
The Lights Out DC campaign urges building owners to switch off unnecessary lights at night during peak migrating periods in the spring and fall.
These are mostly small birds. There's a lot of advantages to flying at night, less predators, there's less thermal upheaval, so they can fly more easily. So they've also speculation that they navigate using the stars.
Now in its fifth year, Fuse says the campaign is having some success. This federal office building has agreed to their request.
Since they've done that, we've seen a two-thirds reduction in the amount of bird fatalities at that site.
Other major U.S. cities have seen similar results, says Ann Lewis, president of City Wildlife, which monitors dead birds through the Lights Out D.C. program.
When they had a large campaign in Chicago to get buildings to turn out lights, the bird mortality was reduced by 80% there.
This year, volunteers have collected almost 400 birds in the small area of Washington. They are cataloged, frozen, and photographed.
The purpose of collecting birds is to have proof that it's a problem. And that's also why we photograph the birds. In the United States, anywhere from 100 million to a billion birds are killed by glass collisions every year. That's sad.
The birds are donated to the National Museum of Natural History, where Brian Schmidt manages the bird collection.
The specimens that we get can be used for a wide variety of studies. One example is researchers look at carbon and nitrogen signatures, and they can determine where did these birds hatch, where did they grow up, and why are they coming through our section of the country.
Volunteers hope their effort will bring increased public interest in the problem, helping to save birds and energy as well. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Medical robots help surgeons perform delicate operations more safely and with greater dexterity than with instruments manipulated by hand. These sophisticated tools also help doctors work more quickly. One such machine reduces the time it takes to manufacture dental crowns to just a couple of hours. VOA's George Putich has more.
Computer-aided medical instruments are increasingly making life easier for doctors and their patients. It used to be that a common but complicated procedure to get a tooth crown required several visits to the dentist's office, while a dental technician was preparing the permanent replacement for a damaged tooth, the patient had to wear a temporary crown. Since mid-1980s, this procedure is gradually being taken over by robotic machines that reduce the job to just over 2 hours. Sitting in the dentist's chair takes even less time.
It's about 12 minutes worth of chair time for the patient. The rest of the time, it's work that's taking place outside the patient's mouth.
At his dental office in Northern Virginia, close to Washington, Michael Silvius and his assistant prepare a patient's tooth for a new crown. The actual drilling takes about 5 minutes. Instead of making the impression of the damaged tooth in a plastic material, Silvius uses a wand with a video camera to scan the tooth and the surrounding area. At this point, the computer takes over, designing the new crown and creating instructions for a robotic milling machine. A porcelain cube, no larger than the tooth, is inserted between two precise drills, similar to the dentist's drill, that grind away excess material, turning the cube into a perfectly matching tooth crown. To harden, the crown must be baked at high temperature for about 10 minutes. During that process, it also gets tinted to match the color of the neighboring teeth, so it is ready to be cemented in the patient's mouth. Patients are pleased with the result.
It feels amazing. The tooth feels like my tooth.
Dr. Silvia says even this technology may someday become obsolete.
The other thing you really look forward to is genetic engineering and eventually cloning so that you can make the crown out of actually enamel, just like the patient's natural teeth are.
But for now, he says, his patients are happy to be able to get a new crown in just one visit. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Attending a live musical performance in a large concert hall, arena, or even an outdoor stadium with thousands of other fans is an amazing experience. Even in a smaller venue, such as a small auditorium, bar, or coffee house, the energy and excitement that can be generated by a gifted performer can be memorable. But here in the United States, a very different kind of performance space is gaining in popularity. Mike Osborne takes us to a house concert in Nashville, Tennessee.
Check, 1, 2.
Singer-songwriter Annalise Emmerich is getting ready to play a show, something she does most nights in coffee houses, bars, auditoriums, and other small venues across the country. But tonight, she'll play for a handful of people in Christina Schultz's living room.
An artist will come into my house and play music, and I don't have to go anywhere. All I have to do is provide the atmosphere, which I am absolutely happy to do.
Schultz has been hosting concerts in her home for about 4 years. She's had as many as 30 people attend, usually a mix of friends, neighbors, family, and even strangers who find the shows listed on house concert websites.
We've done rock, we've had blues, we've had pop, folk, pretty much anything we'll have here.
But this is Annalise Emmerich, and we're very happy to have her straight from East Nashville.
House concerts have become an important part of Emmerich's income.
I can play a bar for $100, but I could play a house concert, and if there's 50 people there and they're all paying $20, like, I'm having a great night, and they're all buying CDs. It's amazing.
So, baby, baby, please come home. Baby, baby, please.
Emmerich says house concert audiences tend to make more dedicated fans. They stay connected, buy her new releases, and show up to hear her the next time she's in town.
It's just a totally unique experience as opposed to playing like a coffee shop or a bar or something like that, where people usually are there, but you don't always know if they're there for you.
Baby, I'm your home, so baby, baby, please come home.
The show's intimate setting appeals to first-time house concert goers Janice and Steve Anderson.
You're just with a bunch of friends. You're sitting around listening to new music, and it's just
kind of like sitting around a campfire outside.
Like she said, it's just a level that you don't get when you go to a concert. It's more personal.
House concerts are gaining in popularity, but can be financially risky for artists. According to Charlie Dayan, he used to book appearances for artists like Annalise Emmerich, and now teaches music management at Middle Tennessee State University.
The downside for the artist is that most house concerts don't pay guarantees, so you have no surety of how much money you're going to make. And in fact, most house concerts by law are not allowed to charge admission. Most of them can only do a suggested donation.
On the other hand, Dan says house concerts can fill empty dates on an artist's calendar and help build a loyal following. Annalise Emmerich says she's played in some houses so often, her hosts have become close friends, even family.
They always say, you know, our door's open if you're traveling through and you need a place to stay in Virginia or something, or Maryland, or wherever you are. And so that's been really nice, too, because these people are just good people that love music.
Emmerich says not every house concert goes quite as planned. She recently booked one in Idaho. Turned out the home was in a nudist colony. For VOA News, I'm Mike Osborne in Nashville.
Nowhere alone on the road.
That is all the time we have for this week's program. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email from wherever you are to our studios in Washington, D.C. You can email us at americancafe@voanews.com. Why not give us a telephone call? Dial the international code, then the number 1 for the United States, followed by 202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA ID, press 05 and then leave your questions or your comments. For all the folks here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll see you next time on American Cafe.